Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, so here's where we are on a Friday. We got the president and the economy. We've got how to profit from your own personal data. And have you heard about this hot new tech company? It's called Ponzify from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday. It's the 8th of June. Good as always to have you with us. And I guess this is what you call the bully pulpit, right? President Obama having a press conference this morning that was very nearly all economy all the time. There was some European debt crisis, some domestic jobs crisis, sometimes both, with a little bit of hope thrown in.
If there's less demand for our products in places like Paris or Madrid, it could mean less businesses or less business for manufacturers in places like Pittsburgh or Milwaukee. The good news is there is a path out of this challenge.
So here to talk about what that path might be and whether there really is one at all are Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, Catherine Rampell from The New York Times. They are in our cozy New York studios for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond. Good to talk to you both.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, Catherine. So in the most layman-like language you can, here's your assignment today. On the assumption that political Washington is out of the equation on finding a path out of this mess, what can be done?
When you say this mess, you're talking about Europe, you're talking about the United States, the whole world.
Yes, continue. Right? Yes.
We were talking earlier about this, and my main solution would be fairy dust. But, you know, it's a very sticky situation pretty much everywhere at this point. I mean, I mentioned Europe and the United States, but there are also concerns about China and other places in the developing world. In the United States, the main objectives that I hear a lot of economists talking about are things that include more government intervention in the economy, whether that means subsidized employment, which it would never happen, tax breaks or whatever. But like you said, politics.
So it has to be the Fed, right, Lee?
I mean, at this point, yes, although the Fed has said, no, we're not going to do anything right now, which, of course, angers those on the right and on the left. And, you know, I think it's actually reassuring that he said that this week. I mean, our economy is, you know, it's anemic, but there is a recovery happening. I mean, even things in housing are looking a little bit better. Autos, there are some signs. But the problem is this global slowdown. At first, it was just Europe. But now we're seeing signs that China, India and Brazil are slowing. That's like, what? I mean, that's you know.
Well, and I would also mention on the Fed that there are concerns about what the Fed could actually do this point. I mean, there were concerns to begin with about the first round of quantitative easing, which was the fancy name for the Fed basically injecting more money into the economy.
Right.
And there's still some debate about how effective that was. There's a lot more debate about how effective the second round was. And many people think that it really didn't do very much. And so that's basically the last tool left in the Fed's toolkit to do another round of quantitative easing. And at this point, how much bigger of a difference could it make?
Can it really be the last tool in the toolkit, Lee? I mean,
it is. I mean, you know, the Fed historically was not supposed to be the keeper of all things. I mean, it's supposed to, you know, look for, you know, maximum employment and you know, I mean, it rates are already zero. The Fed has really done almost everything that it can do. But if you look at Europe, I mean, the Fed actually has a lot more power than the ECB, for example.
Yeah. European Central Bank. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's why the situation over there is so much more grave and so much more pressing right now, because all of this indecision and all of this inactivity, nothing's happening and things are getting worse quickly.
Catherine, do you take any solace from the fact that clearly now, based on Fed Chairman Bernanke's testimony before Congress yesterday and the president today, the issue of Europe is getting some traction? Putting aside the fact that whether or not we can do anything about it, at least they're paying attention.
I mean, this crisis has been going on since 2009.
Right.
it's funny. I mean, I was talking with a friend the other day about how it feels like the crisis in Europe is kind of like a soap opera. It's like every day there's this major dramatic change, and Angela Merkel or somebody's making some incredibly provocative statements, grabbing all the headlines, and at the end of the week, nothing has changed. And so I kind of feel like Europe is getting about as much attention today as it did, you know, 3 years ago, and whether that actually translates to policy action is anyone's guess.
Do either of you share my sense that maybe this time it's real, that Europe is actually at a decision point this summer, Lee?
I feel that way. I mean, for one thing, we're going to have elections in Greece very soon. For another thing, the situation in Spain is really heating up. And Spain is the region's fourth largest economy. It's a much bigger deal than Greece. And, you know, we do seem to be at a different precipice now. Yeah. Things are a lot worse off than they were in December when the first round of the loan program was put in, and that was seen as a big solution, but now it's not that easy.
Catherine, we do seem to be back in the land of weekend bailouts. There are reports out of Spain this week that they're going to go to the European Union this weekend to talk about a bailout.
Yeah, this is again something that I feel like it's some combination of a soap opera and Groundhog Day. I guess I don't know what pop culture reference to use, but it seems like we keep on hearing these types of stories, and then there's a hope that there'll be a magic bullet. But there has been concern about contagion within the financial world, again, for about 3 years now.
Yeah.
And it's not clear whether individual magic bullets like this will actually make any big difference.
Catherine Rampell at the New York Times, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll see you. You know, it's not just the president talking jobs. Our listeners are, too, including DJ Wilson from Edmonds, Washington.
We just hired one person, and we're making an offer next week to another, and I'd like to hire one more in July. But adding just one more person means big costs in terms of our infrastructure.
What's he really worried about, though? Covering retirement benefits.
I run a company with a handful of employees, and I'm trying to expand. I'm the guy that's generating payroll that will be covering those very retirement benefits. Medicare, anyone? Can't they, retirees and, of course, bond-holding institutions, can't they see that their success is tied to my success?
Mr. Wilson owns a PR firm, by the way, in case you were wondering. If you're a small business owner, tell us how it's going. Marketplace.org is our website. On Wall Street today, slow start, strong finish, details, numbers, when we get there. We're still a couple of weeks away from the Supreme Court handing down its decision on health care reform, but one of the most popular parts of that law is in the news today. It's the part that lets young adults stay on their parents' insurance until they're 26. What hasn't really gotten much attention yet is what happens after they turn 26. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the story.
A lot of young adults have gotten on their parents' insurance as a result of the health care law. More than 6 million, according to a study out today from the Commonwealth Fund. But now some of those millions are being dropped from their parents' plans because they've turned 26. Acacia Squires is one of them.
The day of my birthday, they kicked me off. So it was sort of like an unhappy birthday present.
But Squires had planned ahead. She loaded up on health care. She knew she needed to get her wisdom teeth out, so she called her dentist.
And I said, look, I'm turning 26. I'm going to lose my dental insurance. And he said, okay, we're going to get you in.
That was last fall. Since then, Squires got insurance through grad school with no dental coverage. But now she's graduated. Her insurance runs out in August. She knows the health care law's mandate requiring insurance starts in 2014, if it's not found unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. Squires says she'll buy insurance if she doesn't have a job with benefits by then, and insurers are already marketing plans just for her age group. Dr. Alan Muni is chief medical officer at Cigna.
Things happen, you know, when they least expect it. You can get, you know, a bad illness. You can get into an accident.
Costs can add up without insurance. The Commonwealth study also found 44% of young adults from 26 to 29 have had problems paying medical bills. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We came across an interesting SEC filing this week, a prospectus for Silicon Valley's next hot tech stock offering, a company called Ponzify. I'm going to let that sit there for just a little bit. because, yeah, it's not real. It was a satire in McSweeney's that got some attention. Obviously, though, a legal document doesn't work too well on the radio. So we asked the writer John Flowers to give us his fake sales pitch.
Forget Facebook. Forget Groupon. Forget everything you know about Silicon Valley. Because Pontify isn't like other tech companies. We don't promise results. We show them to you on a piece of paper that has your name and a monetary figure that increases every month. Our business model is simple. Attract users, advertisers, positive press, and a corporate buyer. Then pull the cord on that golden parachute and have cable news book you as an expert on startups from time to time. Users love our product because it's something free. Venture capitalists love it because they can imagine themselves talking about it at TED or on Charlie Rose. Trust us. Once you invest in Pontify, you'll have a difficult time investing your money anywhere else ever again. Here is an overview of what we do. Pontify is a solutions-oriented global technology leader that specializes in selling paper products. Apparently, just saying mobile strategy is enough of a mobile strategy. We tried selling our product to users, but that failed miserably. So we turned to an ad-driven model. The way it works is we give away the product for free, then lure advertisers with the promise of connecting them to millions of people who hate to pay for things. Amazingly, it works. Investing in Pontify does involve significant risks. For instance, age factor. Our CEO, CFO, COO, and a bunch of other acronyms were all born after Nirvana released Nevermind. Now, we assume that the net proceeds from the sale of our Class A stocks will net us about $600 million. Also, we plan to pay the following celebrities to appear at our recklessly expensive first anniversary party. Leonard Nimoy, Don Rickles, the Rolling Stones, the entire U.S. women's volleyball team, and the entire cast of Game of Thrones, who will be asked to appear costumed and in character. Now, before we go, there are a few legal notes we are obliged to inform you of. The first is the indemnification of officers and directors of the company. Now, this was like the first thing we did, so don't worry. And then there is the indebtedness of management. Management is fine. It's the company you should be worried about.
Writer John Flowers is the founder of the completely fictitious company Pontify. You can send your investments directly to us if you like. No, I'm just kidding. Comments only, please. We're on Facebook or Twitter at Marketplace APM. One more thing before we move on. I got the name of the president of Ohio State wrong yesterday. It's Gordon Gee, not the way I said it. Coming up, everybody, as you know, wants to make money from your online data. Now you can too.
We said, what would it look like if this person understood how valuable their data was and how, you know, how much better their life could be if they had control over it?
What would it look like indeed? But first, let's do the numbers. For the fourth straight day, the Dow Industrials rose today by 93 points, 0.75%, closed at 12,554. The NASDAQ added 27 points, 0.9%, finished at 2,858. The S&P 500 ticked up 10 points, 0.8%, ended things at 1,325. For the week, the Dow climbed 3.6%, the NASDAQ up 4%. The S&P 500 notched its best week of the year. It advanced 3.7% today. Two digital media companies that have taken their lumps rallied on this Friday. Yelp jumped 12%. Facebook rose 3%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.63%. What's the name of the show? Oh, yeah. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday, everyone's favorite day of the week. The White House holds a town hall meeting with seniors to talk about affordable health care. The event will be streamed live. Apple kicks off its Worldwide Developers Conference in San Francisco. There's an app for it. And on June 11th, 2002, that talent contest, American Idol, launched. Maybe you've heard of it. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
We're back. This is Marketplace from APM on a Friday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As we said when we got going today, Europe is slowly but surely becoming top of mind among people who matter. Ben Bernanke in front of Congress yesterday and the president this morning, where the first question he was asked was a version of this.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
What's up, Europe? Today to Germany, Berlin to be precise, and journalist Thomas Martzall. Thomas, it's good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me on.
So, you know, in these segments, my first question usually has been, so how's the economic mood over there? But I imagine in Berlin, it's not so bad, right?
It's not so bad because, you know, I was walking past a newspaper kiosk today and I saw these sensationalistic headlines on one of the newspapers. They actually did a really good way of pulling you in. Greek default, euro crisis, banks failing, record jobless rates all over Europe. And then underneath, in really big letters, soccer. Because, of course, we've got the European Championships that kicked off just a few hours ago over in Poland and Ukraine, and Germany is the favorite.
That's interesting. So it's not top of mind, this whole European crisis thing.
Well, you know, soccer is spelled with six letters, and denial is also spelled with six letters. So you could say it that way. I mean, it's kind of like we got 4 weeks of games now, and we can kind of tune it all out, and it's summer, there's great weather outside.
It's like an alternate universe.
We can kind of put it off. Of course, at some point, the chickens are going to come home to roost. There's no question about it. And I think the Germans know that, and kind of deep down inside, they can't keep on, sort of keeping the European economy going on their own. But you certainly don't see, you don't see big lines at the banks. And instead, you seem to see big lines outside. Just coming back a few hours ago, the cafes were full of people and the big screen TVs were on and people were tuning into soccer.
You know, I imagine this has not been in the German paper so much, but there's been some sniping over here and in some other European papers that really what's going to happen is it's not going to be the Eurozone anymore. It's going to be the German zone.
Of course, you know, Germany being Europe's largest economy, you know, it's no longer the Franco-German engine. It's the German engine that is driving things forward. At the same time, you have a chancellor who continues to promote Europe. She's not talking about a German-led rescue. She's talking Europe, Europe, Europe until she's blue in the face.
Yeah, but is anybody listening?
That's the question. Yeah. It's the $10 million question. And, you know,
it's the 10 million euro question, man. Come on, get the denominations right.
Or maybe the $10 million renminbi question. Yeah.
Thomas Martzel in Berlin. Thomas, thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Coming up next week, Marketplace's Stephen Beard and Europe as seen from a bar stool. Stephen made the rounds of watering holes in Berlin, Athens, Paris, Madrid, and County Cork. Tough work, I know, but somebody's got to do it. A man walks into a bar. Our series coming Monday. Fashion designer Nolan Miller died this week. He did costumes for dozens of films and television series over the decades, glamorous costumes too. But there was one look he was best known for.
Shoulder pads.
And that made women
bigger, taller, more substantial, let's say.
Shoulder pads were the thing in women's clothing back in the 80s. They made it into evening gowns and business suits. We got fashion writer Kate Betts on the phone and asked her how big a deal Miller and his shoulder pads actually were.
Well, I think it translated because suddenly women were entering the workforce in droves and they were achieving a certain kind of power in the workplace and they needed the armor, or they thought they needed the armor to compete with men.
That's a telling phrase.
Yeah.
But you look back now and you say, gee, was that really such a good look?
Well, yeah. I mean, the proportions have changed significantly. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
But it's funny because he was a costume designer, and costumes are necessarily exaggerations. So it's really a testament to this influence and success of Dynasty, Joan Collins, Linda Evans, Diane Carroll, that his look had such an impact on the culture.
The idea that he was able to get from designing costumes to selling things in retail fashion, and eventually, we should say, like on QVC and all that, I mean, it's sort of an interesting transformation.
It is, but I think it's something that we see a lot now. I mean, now the fashion business has become a global business, and you see entertainment and fashion crossing over, especially commercially. The thing that comes to the top of my head today is somebody like Sarah Jessica Parker. You know, she became Carrie in Sex and the City, and that show also costumes that were highly exaggerated. But had an influence on the culture. And then, you know, you see people like the Olsen twins.
Yeah, Mary-Kate and Ashley, right?
Yeah, now they're, you know, the toast of 7th Avenue with their line. You know, they started off on TV.
Oh, my God, the apocalypse is upon us.
Yeah, exactly. So perhaps Nolan Miller was a trendsetter in more ways than one.
Kate Betts, she's a fashion writer. Her most recent book is called Everyday Icon, Michelle Obama and the Power of Style. Kate, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
You know your personal data isn't really all that personal anymore, right? That every time you search on Google or browse on Amazon, you're sending out at least as much information as you're getting back. So what about this? What about a way to not only control our data, but to get something for it in return? Marketplace's Sally Herships has more on that.
It sounds like a spy novel. Berlin, 2008. Shane Green, an American, is at a meeting near the former headquarters of the Stasi, East Germany's notorious security agency. He's working for Nokia, and the company is worried about competing with Google and Facebook.
And all of the ideas that were being thrown out really had to do with just greater tracking, greater surveilling of people.
And Green is an expert at collecting data.
But it was in that meeting I really had a moment where I said, I'm not going to build that world.
So he started building a different one, one that doesn't snoop on consumers or sell our data. Green founded a website, personal.com, where consumers are in charge. It lets you store personal information you can share with friends and family without being tracked. And later this year, you'll also be able to share it with retailers.
We said, what would it look like if this person was in on the joke, if this person understood how valuable their data was and how, you know, how much better their life could be if they had control over it.
Here's how it will work. Say I'm shopping for jeans. I can log in to my personal.com account. Jeans. My preferences. A dark wash. Size 8, 6 at the Gap. And no low rise, please. Personal keeps my data private, but I can choose to open it up to retailers. The idea is for them to make offers, including discounts, for my business. If I buy, personal.com gets a cut of the discount. When I'm done, I can lock up my data to make it private again. So why don't more companies do business this way? Doc Searles is an expert on consumers controlling their own data. He just wrote a book called The Intention Economy, When Customers Take Charge. He says companies are too busy chasing us on the internet, trying to read our minds, instead of asking what we want.
We're going to guess better than you can at the next thing you're going to want. And there's just, in addition to just the privacy violation aspects of that, there's just bad guesswork as well.
Think about it. When was the last time you clicked on an ad on Facebook? Searle says internet tracking isn't paying off. Personal is one of many new companies popping up to focus on what you could call small data. Another company doing this is Enliken. Its software tracks you online, just like a retailer. And Enliken sells your data to advertisers. But
we believe it's your right to own a copy of that information and decide who benefits from it.
You get to donate your data to a nonprofit. Well, you get to donate the money from the sale of your data. Enliken takes a 20% cut.
If I can direct revenue to a charity versus just revenue straight to Google, I'm all for it. So to me, it's kind of, power to the people, if you will.
Keith Woodley works for Souls for Souls, a charity that donates shoes to the needy. Souls for Souls just launched its first Enliken campaign. It emailed 80,000 supporters. Woodley says as a fundraising tool, Enliken has a major selling point for consumers.
This is not their money. It doesn't cost them anything.
Remember, the money is coming from advertisers. Enliken estimates each person's data will bring in about $10 a year, which could add up if people respond like Cindy Maloof in Los Angeles. She wasn't that worried about installing Enliken.
Well, I feel actually a little less offended. I feel a little less invaded because I have some sense of where the proceeds of that data is going.
Maloof uses Enliken to donate to a nonprofit that helps families volunteer together. She says there's so much information about her already floating around the internet. Why not put it to use for good? In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on a Friday, it comes from our own Rico Galliano and Brendan Francis Noonan in a podcast they do called The Dinner Party Download, in which we escape the big news of the day and catch up on what didn't quite make the headlines.
Shireen Marisol Meraji, Wealth and Poverty Reporter, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Zombie bullets.
What are zombie bullets?
There's this company called Hornady Manufacturing, and they make a bullet to kill zombies. This is real ammunition. Zombie-killing ammunition.
But there's no zombies. This is like a novelty to sell to zombie fans or something.
Yes, it is. And it's a big seller. It's their number one selling bullet.
Do they have silver bullets for vampire fans?
Garlic bullets? I have no idea.
Woody Allen fans could get corduroy bullets to slay your superego.
Stacey Vanek Smith, senior reporter. What's your story?
Well, a company called NovoAd has developed advertisements that will run in public bathroom mirrors.
So people are going to be combing their hair and instead looking at a burrito?
No, not exactly. So you'll see yourself, but then like along the side of the mirror, you'll see ads. But actually, this is the part that concerns me. I mean, if I saw an ad for wrinkle cream, I think I would start crying.
Exactly. Or you look like you're in the market for a funeral plot.
Ethan Lindsay, producer of the Marketplace Morning Report. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Redbox, those video rental kiosks outside your local 7-Eleven.
Yes.
Disney is worried that video rentals at the Redbox are cutting into their DVD sales. So Disney's telling Redbox that they can't rent their videos until they've been on sale for 56 days.
Which seems like a long time, I guess.
Redbox sure thinks so. And so they're sending employees out to buy Disney movies, John Carter, what have you, and putting those movies in Redboxes. And Disney, obviously, not very happy about it.
Really? I would think they'd be super happy that someone actually spent money on John Carter. That's amazing.
There is oh so much more where that came from. There's a link to the whole radio show that Rico and Brendan do on our website. It's marketplace.org. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, from public radio host to interning.
One of the biggest jobs of being an intern here is watching television, hours and hours and hours of really bad
that
television.
Sounds very taxing.
It is. I mean, you can only watch so many hours of the Today Show and The View before you want to throw up.
True that. Tess Vigeland goes back to square one. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.